Imagine a world where historically money-hungry and corrupt sports entities like the IOC, FIFA, and NCAA did anything possible to make a buck, use their athletes as pawns and push ridiculous rules to either circumvent opposition or to virtue signal or take attention away from their own issues. Wait a minute. Do we have to imagine? On Book Spectrum today, I have a guest who takes the real situation in college athletics, focusing on the National Collegiate Athletic Association, and placing an exponential version of it into an alternate, or rather dystopian, universe. MK Lever is not simply an author. She has experience with the real NCAA, and she's a former Division I athlete, as well as a PhD candidate at UT Austin. In her first and new book, Surviving the Second Tier, MK combines her personal experiences as a student athlete and the weight of her academic research in areas concerning NCAA discourse, rhetoric, and policy to create her rather thought-provoking literary debut. Surviving the Second Tier depicts a new day in college athletics, where there are no more football games, lacrosse teams, and basketball tournaments, as the NCAA would, in this world, create the bare-bones but extremely profitable Amateur Fighting Association. Yes, it might be a very interesting and different world, but there are parallels to this one. Welcome to Book Spectrum, MK Lever.
What an introduction. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for coming on, MK. Surviving the Second Tier is an interesting book on many levels, and your first one. Still, while the subject's close to you, you're a quite busy grad student working on your PhD. What inspired you to write this story now?
So I started the book in 2018, around the same time that I was starting my PhD. At the time, I was big into researching policy, and it's still a big part of my research. But policy research isn't all that interesting to people. And so when I would discuss my research with people, I began to use a metaphor. I would say, oh, the NCAA is a dystopia. And it really resonated with people. Their eyes would light up and they'd get interested in my research. So I realized that it was a good vehicle to talk about what I was studying. And over time, I started to build these characters and this world in my head, and it got to the point where I was just losing sleep over all of these ideas, and I just had to get them on paper. I'd never intended to publish it. So I would chip away at it. I would maybe write a paragraph a day or so, just whenever I had ideas. And then around this first spring semester of my PhD, I realized I had about 90 pages, and I was like, that's a manuscript. I should probably do something with it. And then I finished it a little under 2 years later, and now it is out, which is really exciting.
How did you manage to even find the time to do it?
I had to make time for it. I did not sleep much that first year because I found that I was really good at writing late at night and early in the morning. And so I would just, after class or after I was done TAing, I would just sit down and I would write. And it was pretty much just whenever I had the time. If I had 5 minutes, I would take that 5 minutes and write. If I had 20 minutes or an hour, I would take that time. And so it was really just a matter of me making time for something that I really, really, truly wanted to do.
Surviving the Second Tier draws from elements of your own experiences as a college athlete, MK. Let's talk about some of them.
Yeah, so when I moved to Austin, I met a couple of women in the interpersonal communication department, and they study abusive relationships. And so it's kind of the dark side of interpersonal communication. And I thought the research was really interesting, and we would talk about it pretty frequently. And the more we talked about it, the more I realized that a lot of the abusive relationship habits that they research are also very present in college sports, in these relationships between athletes and coaches. And so I realized over time that I was actually in an abusive relationship with some of my coaches in college. And that was just a really stark realization for me. And it was one of the drivers for the book as well. Because the more I looked into it, the more I realized that my circumstances are not unique. There aren't a lot of statistics about athlete abuse, but anecdotal evidence shows that they're fairly common, and that there are a lot of structures set up in the NCAA, especially in terms of policy and a lack of regulations that enable coaches to abuse their athletes through scholarship policies and other power imbalances that are just inherent to college sports. So it's a really personal story for me. It also draws on a lot of my research, and there's a surprising amount of policy research in this novel.
The book is character-driven and centers around a woman named Cicely Jones, Sis, as she's referred to throughout the book. She pushes her way through injury and stress to maintain both her fighting prowess, her record, and her perfect GPA. There's a lot of pressure on her. There are also other characters she deals with. You talk about abusive relationships with coaches and teammates, things like that. What are some parallels between you and Sis, or maybe some of your fellow athletes and Sis?
A lot of athletes are just incredibly driven to succeed in their sport, and that sort of success orientation can be very good for them as athletes, but it can also be harmful for them as people. And it was something that I engaged in myself, but I also noticed it in some of my teammates. You know, we would be training through injuries. We'd be training when we were sick. We would be out on the roads running when it was icy or when, you know, the temperature was in the teens. And so there's this very blind drive that a lot of athletes have. You know, like I said, that is very, very beneficial when you want to be at the top of your game, but it's hard to humanize yourself and turn that off and sometimes take rest days or just take time for yourself or put yourself before the team when it's healthy to do so. And so that was a dynamic that I really wanted to explore and write about. And I also have had a lot of personal experience with injuries as a college athlete, most of them overuse injuries. And that was something that really affected my not only my career, but also just my physical health, my mental health. There's still things that I deal with day to day. They've gotten manageable, but for a long time, they really restricted my mobility and my quality of life. And the NCAA also does not cover athletes insurance-wise after they graduate. Some universities do for a year or so, but as far as long-term insurance policies go, that coverage stops for most athletes once they graduate. So it's a big issue in college sports.
That would have to be an issue, especially if you look at college football or college basketball, where there are constant injuries going around. You bring up a good point, because a lot of times these athletes want to go into the next level, and they use their college scholarships to do so. On the other hand, the NCAA is also, or at least these colleges, are also looking to use the athlete to gain prominence athletically and maybe pull some more money into their own university coffers. Yet, once somebody gets hurt and maybe has trouble doing what they'd like to do moving forward, it's almost like the NCAA and colleges wash their hands of that responsibility.
Yeah, I'd say that's a very accurate statement. And another thing, too, we talked a little bit about my research and policy. Scholarship policies are a big part of that, because a lot of people think that college athletes in the NCAA all have 4-year full ride guaranteed deals. But the reality is that most NCAA scholarships are renewable, which means that they expire at the end of an athletic season. And so athletes have to constantly earn those scholarships year after year after year. And so what a coach can potentially do is a coach can say, I don't care if you're hurt. You need to do what's best for the team and push through this injury, or I'm going to pull your scholarship. And I've had that happen to me, too, with my coaches.
MK Lever is with me on Book Spectrum. We're talking about her book, Surviving the Second Tier. Along with your experiences, how has your academic research in NCAA policy and discourse influenced the story?
Oh, so much. It was actually an assignment in a rhetoric class that first got me interested in NCAA policy. The first time I'd ever opened an NCAA policy book was actually in grad school. I just listened to what my coaches told me in college, because NCAA policy is very dense and very complicated. And so it was through the experience of actually reading through policies and seeing the policy gaps that harm athletes that got me thinking critically about college sports after I had graduated. And the best example of this came in, I believe it was either 2017 or 2018, when the Larry Nassar trial was going on. I remember there was a headline that said NCAA clears Michigan State of all wrongdoing in the Larry Nassar trial. And at the time, I was reading through the NCAA's Division I manual, which is their official rule book. And I remember thinking, that has to be against the rules, right? Like sexual abuse of athletes, that has to be an NCAA violation. And so I read through the manual, which is about 400 pages long, and I couldn't find any rule that that prohibited coaches and trainers from sexually abusing the athletes that they oversee. And I learned later that it actually is not a violation of NCAA policies, which is why the NCAA let Larry Nassar off the hook. And so it's just policy gaps like that that really influence not only my research, obviously, but also my writing, my creative writing, my freelance writing, and my advocacy efforts.
The NCAA likes to hide under the guise of virtue signaling when it comes to real issues. You brought up the Nassar situation. That was pretty horrible. And anybody wants to look that up, it's easy to Google. It was a big story for a long time. But the NCAA has always been on the forefront of what they call equality. Title IX. You can say what you want about that. There's been positives and negatives to that, but they like to hold their hat on that to show the world, hey, we're a great organization. They're also in the middle of this controversy about male-female trans athletes competing with women. They want to go on the virtue side, while a lot of female athletes who've worked very hard are not very happy with this idea either. They have to make a decision on this, but they like to stay on the forefront while very serious things are happening underneath that surface. This is where surviving the second tier really goes deeply in. This is where our discussion goes as well. You talked about what happens with the year-to-year scholarships. You talked about what happens when athletes don't get to, or they get hurt and the NCAA won't help them out after they graduate. Another issue is for decades, they've been making a lot of money off the names and likenesses of their athletes. Athletes that don't get paid, athletes that don't get any sort of compensation or deals when it comes to advertising, television revenue, radio revenue, and in recent years, recent decades for that matter, their likenesses and names in video games. That was a big deal until very recently when, incidentally, Ed O'Bannon fought hard for college athletes to get some compensation for that.
Yeah, it's interesting that you brought up virtue signaling because that's something that I've seen a lot as name, image, and likeness has come to fruition for college athletes. The NCAA has been saying for years now that we are trying to innovate. We're on the athlete's side here. We want to create these policies that benefit athletes. But the NCAA has historically been against name, image, and likeness reform for decades. And name, image, and likeness is a great development for college athletes. I'm not going to deny that. But there are so many other issues that are being swept under the rug. And there's a lot of this triumphalism around NIL, like, oh, these college athletes can now earn money from their name, image, and likeness. And so everything is right and well in college sports. But that ignores the issues of, you know, you mentioned Title IX non-compliance, sexism, LGBT discrimination, exploitation, injuries, abuse. And so name, image, and likeness is such an important development for college athletes, but it's just the very beginning of college sports reform.
What do you hope surviving the second tier will accomplish in the conversation around censorship, control, corruption, exploitation, abuse, and other issues within the college sports industry?
Oh, yeah. These issues are not just relegated to the NCAA. And so a big goal of surviving the second tier was to humanize athletes, because I know as a former college athlete myself, it's very tempting to view yourself as an athlete in terms of your output. So looking at statistics or the times that you throw down on the track or what you're doing for your team. And then fans tend to do the same. We look at athletes as, you know, markers and points on our fantasy leagues or how many dollars they earn in their salaries. But we don't really see the human side of athletes at a lot of different levels. And so a big goal was to invite the reader to live in the lifestyle of a college athlete for a little while, to feel empathy and to feel the struggles and the pain and the joy that college athletes experience, and to just bring a more well-rounded picture of what it means to be a college athlete while also educating readers about the issues that they face. And I just hope that readers will watch college sports differently after they read my book.
MK Lever is with us on Book Spectrum. She's the author of Surviving the Second Tier. As a third-generation Division I athlete, what improvements has your family seen with college athletics today than how business was done within those confines during previous generations? Because there was some progress over the years. We did talk about one issue, but there were a lot of shady things going on back then.
Yeah, well, I think one thing that's improved in some ways for sure has been health and safety measures. There are still a lot of problems here in the NCAA, but my grandpa was a football player and he played, you know, with leather helmets. He would get a concussion and then just go out onto the field and continue playing. And so there have been some improvements there for sure. There's still a long way to go, but there has been progress. And my mom was the first generation of college athletes to compete post Title IX. And so gender equity is also another one of those things that has a long way to go in college sports. About 80% of Division I institutions are not compliant with Title IX, even though it's a federal law. And Sedona Prince from the University of Oregon last year exposed holes in the NCAA's commitment to gender equity during March Madness. And so there has been a lot of pushing for progress in that area. And it's exciting to see just women becoming more prominent in college sports, especially through name, image, and likeness, because female athletes are doing very, very well. So even though there is still a lot that's wrong with college sports, there are also improvements, like you said.
From where you sit, MK, what aspects of college athletics are most in need of reform? And what can diehard and casual fans of college football, basketball, and other sports do to help straighten things out?
That's a really great question. I think that the biggest thing is it's actually the topic of my dissertation. I'm looking at paternalism in college sports and the ways that college athletes are infantilized and controlled by the media and the NCAA. And one of the biggest issues in the college sports industry is the fact that college athletes are very often told what they can and cannot do rather than having the power to advocate for themselves and say, we as a players organization or as a union, we want this and this and this from our athletic department or from our conference. And that could be things like health and safety measures, improved access to mental health resources, a better work-life balance with their school and sports and their personal lives. And so there are a lot of different ways that unionization and just athletes being able to advocate for themselves can benefit them. And I would say the best thing that college sports fans can do if they want to help athletes is to pay attention to which politicians are sponsoring bills at the state and the federal level and to get involved there, whether it's just, sending a letter and writing a politician or voting a little bit differently. There are ways that sports fans can get involved. And there are also organizations like the Drake Group, which is an athletic advocacy organization that I'm a part of, that college sports fans can also donate to monetarily and support through social media and through attending online events and getting our mission out as well.
We got through the background, MK. Surviving the Second Tier is a book that takes place in an alternate reality in this novel. We know that the NCAA in this world is a very powerful entity, but you take that to the nth power in this one. It also includes aspects of what's happening today in both college sports and the rest of the world. What was your thought process in creating this universe for the book Surviving the Second Tier?
Well, the big aspect of Surviving the Second Tier is the world building part of it. So I envision this alternate world, as you said, where college sports fans are just enthralled by the violence of a fighting league. It's very glamorized. And that's something that I would say definitely happens with college and professional football. We know that the sport causes brain damage. We know that it's dangerous. We know that it's harmful to athletes. And there are still huge entire industries dedicated to them. And so I wanted to draw some attention to that. And then even though the NCAA has been losing some pretty significant legal battles lately, they still exert a lot of control over college athletes. And even when the NCAA doesn't directly exert control, you can still see athletic departments or conferences or coaches exerting control over athletes in a more closed setting, like a team setting. And so I wanted to really get at the just the violence of a lot of college sports that are popular and how it's problematic that we glamorize that, and also just the amount of control that is exerted over college athletes.
Keep in mind, these athletes don't get paid. They don't get real compensation. Yes, it can be argued that many of them get full scholarships, and that in turn counts as pay. On the other hand, a lot of money is really going through the NCAA and these colleges in comparison. We can talk about all of that, but something else you bring up in the book, which reflects greatly on our own world. In your book, it's the conglomeration of the NCAA sports into an all-around amateur fighting association. That's not necessarily far apart from the ultimate fighting craze in real life today. Americans seem to be enamored with this combination of pro wrestling, martial arts, and boxing. And we have to say the boxing industry's historic corruption and hype in some parts has everything to do with UFC's success in the real world.
Yeah, and I do think that it's a trend in the American sports market is that fans just seem to be really enamored by hyper-violent sports that have the potential to cause long-term harm to athletes. And you mentioned the UFC. A lot of the same issues that college athletes face, UFC fighters also face because they're independent contractors. They make a lot of their money through their third-party endorsements rather than through the UFC itself. They have to pay for their own insurance. And then there's, you know, obviously the long-term health associated risks that come with just a high-risk lifestyle like that. And so there are a lot of reflections between the NCAA and the UFC as well.
You also bring up, and we discussed this a bit earlier in the interview, but you bring up in the book the dehumanization of athletes. This also goes with professional athletes. It's easy for a fan to sit back and say, hey, let's trade this guy for this guy. Or, boy, does this person stink. Oh, these colleges, they should play the backup quarterback instead of the starting quarterback. Or basically, all they see is what they see on television. They don't know what kind of work goes on behind it, what kind of struggles each individual player has. They have family lives. Maybe they have struggles with addiction. Maybe they are trying to work extra hard to play better. Maybe a college athlete's kind of struggle to their grade point average up to a certain point where they can just stay on the team and not get kicked out of the league. These things are not taken into consideration by the average fan that often, and your book, Surviving the Second Tier, reflects that and reflects those pressures on athletes like Sis.
Oh, yeah. There are so many different pressures on college athletes, and it's a very difficult lifestyle to understand unless you've actually been there. But just balancing a high-level athletic career with college-level academics is extremely difficult. Injuries can really hurt athletes, not only physically, but mentally. There are lots of athletes who actually live at or below the poverty line. I had teammates in college who were sending rent checks home to their families in between meets, saving up per diem for that. And so a lot of the issues that college athletes face are difficult to understand from an outsider's perspective. And it also doesn't help that, you know, sports fans do see these college athletes on TV and they're just at their peak physical performance. And there are all these great graphics and showmanship that goes into the production of sports entertainment in general. And so it really is easy to put aside the fact that college athletes are people too, and that they have these real human issues and that they don't just exist solely for audience consumption.
MK Lever, your first dive into dystopian fiction reveals this fascinating mind, both creative and analytical. Do you intend to put these skills to the pen again in the future?
Well, thank you for that. I appreciate it. I definitely would like to write more creative fiction. I'm so used to academic writing and reporting and journalism and things like that. And so it's really just, for me, honestly, it's just a really fun thought exercise to be able to take what I know in these very strict and academic and fact-based areas and translate that into something that I'm hoping is going to be very universally enjoyable and understandable and will really change the way that people look at college sports and college athletes. So I would absolutely love to continue writing about issues like this.
MK Lever, thank you for being here on Book Spectrum with us.
Thank you so much for having me, Chris. I appreciate it.
Once again, the book is Surviving the Second Tier. You can pick it up on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or wherever you get your books. You also can find a link on our website, bookspectrum.com. I'm Chris Cordani, your host. Thank you for listening to Book Spectrum.